You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.
We are happy now to have some time to talk about some wine country things, wine industry things, and joining us now is Esther Mobley from San Francisco Chronicle, where she writes about wine and other beverages. Good morning.
Good morning.
Been a while since we talked. How have you been?
I've been doing well, still working from home like many people are in the Bay Area.
I guess that's one thing. You can be a writer from just about anywhere, right?
Yeah. I miss going into the newsroom in downtown San Francisco, but the news still goes on, and it's been fun to see how we can still put out a paper every day from our disparate little homes.
So you've had two recent columns that I read your column all the time, but the two particularly caught my eye. And the first one was writing about the wine auction, the Napa Valley Wine Auction, which became Auction Napa Valley in its later years. Mm-hmm. And your take on it was, as some have, you know, speculated, it may never come back based on new conditions. Elaborate on that thought a little bit.
Well, that's based on statements that the Napa Valley vintners have made. And the kind of time hook for writing this column is that right now, or excuse me, last week, a virtual auction was underway that was, a kind of stand-in for the in-person auctions. Of course, this time of year would also be when another auction is happening in Napa Valley, Premier Napa Valley, an auction of barrel wine and barrel that is primarily oriented toward the trade. But I thought it was a fitting time to reflect on the higher profile auction, Auction Napa Valley, which happens in the spring and won't be happening this year. And the Napa Valley vintners have said that they plan to take the year to kind of reassess what it could look like in the future. So I think the implication is, you know, there may be some event, some fundraiser that happens, but that it won't be exactly like the auction that's been taking place at Meadowood for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Did you get the feeling from what you've discerned that that the event had sort of grown out of scale, or that it was difficult to sustain it? It always felt to me like those in the media, at least, and local people were waiting for that big figure. Like, did they break the record again this year? And if they didn't, then was that a failure? Whose fault is that? Kind of feeling. Is that part of the problem?
Well, the Napa Valley vintners, I haven't heard them say anything exactly to that effect, but I'm sure that the mounting pressure, as you say, to top each previous year's record was serious, and they often didn't top each year's record in terms of how much they generated, and those are some. It was getting to be some big numbers. I mean, individual auctions at some point in the last 10 years, you know, could reach almost 20 million. And often you were depending on kind of a single auction lot, a single generous bidder, a single bidding war to get up to that figure. So it could be, I think, probably pretty hard to plan for. The Napa Valley Vintners, I know, has still made significant donations to some of the community organizations that would have benefited from the auction this year, even though there is no auction. But what I would say is the more important point, maybe, and what I suspect the vintners would acknowledge, is that, you know, this event over the course of its 40 years really probably took on a life that no one could have imagined it would. Regardless, you know, even in, apart from the sum that it would raise, the kind of extravagance of it seemed to always be getting higher and higher. I think, one criticism a lot of folks have made is that it became less and less about the wine and more about the kind of over-the-top experiences that got tacked on to the wine lots.
And private super jet trips around exclusivity, the world. Right?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. So so I think, you know, COVID in a way, it's probably doing this for a lot of things, but just giving a kind of nice excuse to take a step back and say, hey, what's this thing really about?
Well, and that's one thing that I felt about it as, you know, my family's in the wine industry. We've been in the wine industry for years. We're the second oldest family still producing wine today in the Napa Valley. And the wine auction was something we never attended because, quite frankly, we couldn't afford to. And I'm not saying that is a negative thing. We just, we're a small family business. And when I first moved back from college, there may have been a chance that I could participate. We always participated in Premier Napa Valley. We had some play in auction Napa Valley early on, but as it continued to grow, I think you nailed it. It became less about the wine and more about the experiences and the dinners. And that's just something that
celebrities.
And that's mm-hmm. something we didn't do. So it kind of left us on the outskirts, and that's fine. But I think this opportunity would be a great way for the vintners to kind of reopen it again, make it less exclusive. You have the ability to, a lot of the events like that, a lot of the you know, success of it is getting the right people in the room at the right time under the right situation that they want to bid and they want to spend their money. But if you have access open across the world, I mean, even if it's in a virtual format, just think of the reach and the possibilities you could have if you're super creative about creating an event like that. Yeah. That's just more open.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly a criticism that's been made many times of the event. The, you know, if one goal of the auction, you know, over the last 40 years was kind of PR for Napa Valley wine and raising the profile of Napa Valley wine, I think it was really a success in that way. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was trying to get at in the column in part. I mean, I think it you know, created this sense of value for a lot of these wines. The prices were these kind of jaw-dropping figures, and that was, I think, really good for creating buzz. I think a winery like Grace Family Vineyards throughout the 1980s, its reputation was really in large part made by auction Napa Valley. And so, you know, I think that's one thing that is interesting just to measure over the last several decades, but that's come with all kinds of other drawbacks, like what you're describing, Taylor, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. So I believe the vendors are saying they'll have something in a few months about future of the auction. Is that correct?
Yeah. I don't know the exact time frame that they plan to announce something, but we'll be eagerly awaiting their news.
Mm-hmm. And I did see one story here. Their headline was that $933,000 was raised by this most recent virtual auction event. That's a pretty good sum.
Well, it sounds pretty good. It's, you know, a fraction of what the in-person auction might have generated, but certainly that's great that they'll be able to direct a lot of money still to the very deserving community yeah. organizations
for sure.
in your backyard.
Yeah. So let's turn to another story you've written about, and that is a couple of notable large wine companies getting ready to go public. And that hasn't happened in a while. It's a pretty rare event, and some people would say doesn't always turn out well for everybody involved. Talk about that story a little bit.
Yeah, you know, we heard the news a few weeks ago that Vintage Wine Estates, which is a company based in Santa Rosa that owns about 50 different wine brands, was planning to go public. And so I got on the phone with its CEO, Pat Roney, talked to him about it. And then, you know, it's interesting in its own right. But then we heard that Duckhorn might be going public. And I should say, Duckhorn would not actually ever confirm this for me. But Bloomberg has reported that a plan is in the works. Anyway, it's interesting because really the last major winery IPO in California was Ravenswood in 1999. And when you think about it, essentially the three main California wine companies that had gone public that we think of, Ravenswood, Mondavi, and Chalon, all in, you know, between 2000 and 2005 had a kind of major reckoning in which control of the company was transferred. And, you know, we could argue whether those were beneficial for the companies or not. Certainly in some, by some measurements, they were successes and that shareholders got some returns on them. But, you know, a lot of folks, myself included, think that those were turning points that might have kind of turned some of those wineries onto paths that weren't fully aligned with the highest quality that they had once reached and the kind of identity that had drawn their customers to them. So to me, it's a really interesting development that we haven't had this for essentially 20 years. And now suddenly this spring, we may have two wineries in the Bay Area going public all of a sudden. It's a big, that's a notable development.
Yeah, for sure. And like you say, it hasn't happened very often in Napa. And when it has, it hasn't yielded for everybody the outcome that you're hoping for, I guess, which is some magical combination of that family-oriented, high-quality winery and also profitable for people other than the family, as it were.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of folks, even I, who I'm not a business reporter, but you could step back and see a lot of ways in which a typical Napa or Sonoma winery doesn't seem like the ideal type of company to go public. I mean, these are multi-generational companies. Often growth is not the goal. Growth is often not the way to get the best product out there and to have the most success in the long term. You know, apart from the fact that it's hard to predict how harvests will go, whether it'll be a good year, whether it'll be a bad year, a big year, a small year. We've certainly seen the whiplash of that over the last several years. So it's hard to kind of square that with the type of being the type of business that needs kind of consistent quarterly growth. So it's interesting. I think the caveat is that vintage wine estates, especially and to some extent Duckhorn too, are really different types of companies from Mondavi, Chalon, and Ravenswood in a lot of ways. Vintage wine estates is growing like crazy. I mean, the company really only started in 2008. Before that, it had just been Girard Winery. Pat Roney, the CEO, has told me their average annual growth has been 20%. He's basically going public in order to get access to a lot more capital so that he can just continue buying up new wineries.
We'll be anxious to track this and learn more about it as the weeks roll by. There's one other subject I'd like to chat with you about and get your thoughts on, and that is, of course, smoke taint and fire impacts and all that. We've had the 17 vintage and now the 2020 vintage. We know that last year's yield was way off, in part because, or at least our tonnage was way off because of, in part, smoke taint problems. What have we learned in these couple of years about this problem? Is it really that significant? Can people actually perceive the difference in some of these wines? There was a lot of speculation last year that maybe some folks were canceling contracts because of oversupply more than because of worries about smoke taint.
Yeah, it's you're hitting on all the reasons why it's such a thorny and complicated issue. I think still, unfortunately, the only thing we know is that we don't know enough. There's still very little research, really relatively, on smoke taint and on the impacts. You know, for instance, One problem is that all wine grapes, many wine grapes contain to some degree low levels of these compounds that we consider markers for smoke taint. And we don't have a kind of widespread sense of what the normal levels of those are, so that when someone gets a smoke taint test, they can tell, oh, these are elevated levels of guaiacol, for instance. Sometimes they might just be normal levels of guaiacol. And, you know, that smoky flavor you often find in Syrah is, that's part of the grape. And it doesn't always necessarily mean it's been compromised by smoke. And so some labs recommend that you don't even send Syrah grapes or wine in for testing, because they think that the results would still be meaningless. And then there's all kinds of other complications in terms of whether you can perceive the smoke impact in a wine depends on so many other things. You know, to some degree, it depends on the stage of life that the wine is in, and it may manifest differently at different points in the wine. It may depend on how much else is going on in the wine. You know, if you have a kind of complex big red wine that has a lot of tannin, a lot of alcohol, those things may actually mask smoke taint more. There's so many questions that remain for this, and there's certainly a lot of interest being put into figuring out some of these things, and especially into creating this kind of database I was alluding to earlier, where you could say, okay, these are the normal levels of guaiacol in North Coast Cabernet Sauvignon. So then when you get a test back, you can measure it against the baseline. A place like Australia is a lot further ahead of us than that already. But there's so many other issues that go into it. I mean, the question of how do we get more folks insured? Are the subsidies that exist for crop insurance sufficient right now? Some folks have said that even with the correction of yields in this vintage, it may not be enough to correct the kind of surplus and oversupply we've had. And there still may be many acres of vineyards throughout California that need to get removed. You know, I don't know the final word on any of that. And in the meantime, I think a lot of individual wineries are still assessing really what to do with their wine from 2020. Those who have still been, you know, holding out on making some. And I think certainly I'm confident that by the time 2020 wines get released, those are going to have been vetted so carefully, and those are going to be the really good wines. That there may be fewer of them, but I believe that the ones we're able to get on the shelf will have passed some pretty intense scrutiny in the wineries.
That's a confidence builder. So last question, easy one. It's going to be warm here in Napa next couple of days, but still later in the week, mid-60s, upper 60s. Not quite rosé weather. So what's a good varietal choice for this season?
It's been so gorgeous. I don't think rosé is a bad idea at all. I think you could go with a kind of a light red, a kind of chill, even a wine that could take a slight bit of a chill. You mm-hmm. could find a kind of light bodied Pinot Noir or Gamay, or go to the Italian shelf at the wine shop and pick up a bottle of Dolcetto. I think that's a kind of nice style of wine to bridge winter into spring.
We make a Dolcetto.
Do you?
We do.
Well, that's great. Well, everyone check out the Madonna Estate Dolcetto.
Those are good recommendations.
Barry made a face at me when you said that, because it never failed. I would always bring Dolcetto anywhere, like if I would go out to do a tasting somewhere, because it's such, not many wineries produce it. And I would always get, tell me about your Dolcetto. That was the number one question. So Barry was known to like stalk me and come just because he could hang out and get free wine. And so he'd always sneak up and go, can you tell me about your Dolcetto? I'd be like, oh my gosh, stop.
Yeah, the question you get too much of.
Oh yeah.
All right. Esther Mobley, who writes about wine and other beverages for the San Francisco Chronicle, and enjoy reading your stuff every week. Thanks for being on the show today again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Barry, and thanks, Taylor.
Yeah.
Take care.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
That was fun.
You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.